don't love you back. Stay tuned every Wednesday at 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 8:30 Pacific, with your host, Boyd and Lucinda, for the hottest talk show in existence. The streets don't love you back. I gotta do right before they call me
home. Good evening and welcome to the Streets Don't Love You Back show. I'm your host, Lucinda, with my co-host, Boyd. And our topic is, as always, the streets don't love you back. Join us every Wednesday night with real people, real stories, and real changes as we hear the truth about gangs, drugs, violence, abuse, and other life issues. We have a great show for you tonight. We have Miss Thelma Wright. She was legendary as reputedly the most dangerous, powerful black woman in Philadelphia. As the wife of Jackie Wright, a top heroin dealer in the city, she was intricately connected with the Black Mafia, a gang that operated Philly's drug trade throughout the 1970s and into the 1980s. Once widowed and left as a young mother of a toddler son, she discreetly took over his business, running a bi-coastal drug empire, unbeknownst to family and friends around her. Recognized by her distinguished, sparkling green eyes, Wright ruled the streets with incredible savvy and disarming charm, yet very few knew the real sadness and confusion in her heavy heart. So listen in tonight for this awesome story, and before we bring her on, let me welcome Boyd to the show.
Yeah. I would just like to say thank everybody who tuned into our radio show every Wednesday night. And we just want to first off thank our soldiers inside the prison walls who are down with the team, 150 prisoners that roll with the streets and love you back, federal and state men and women. And I'd like to give a shout out to my three brothers, Robbie, Marvell, and Christopher, serving life sentence. And just our soldiers out here in the street, man, that's educating these kids, man, that the streets definitely don't love you back. They'll never love you back. The drug game is a deadly game. It don't love nobody, and your own homeboy and homegirl will turn that game all the way around. So listening tonight to a very powerful story, and with that being said, we're going to bring Ms. Thelma Wright on, and she's going to formally introduce herself. You're on the air, Ms. Wright.
Well, thank you so much for having me. My name is Thelma Wright, and I'm the author of With Eyes from Both Sides, Living My Life in and Out of the Game. I must apologize to you tonight. I'm a little under the weather, but I am here, so I will do my best to get through this.
Hey, we just want to say we're very honored to have you on the show, and we thank you for coming on the show. So we would just like for you to start off, Ms. Wright, on your childhood and lead up to how did you get in the game?
Well, I grew up in South Philly. I come from a two-parent household, Catholic school educated. Basically, my parents were very involved in the community with sports and all types of athletic, both being powerhouse basketball players. My brothers were also ball players, and as myself, pretty much I could have done anything in life. After graduating from high school, I met someone who was heavily involved in the drug game, 10 years my senior, Jackie Wright. And it was told to me that prior to our relationship, Jackie was deeply involved with the Black Mafia. And we dated for some years, had our son in 1982, things were going really good. He had a great run. And in August of 1986, my husband was murdered because he did someone a favor. He looked out for a guy, fronted him a key of cocaine, and the guy was, I guess, not able to pay because of his own drug usage. He murdered my husband in August of 1986. After his demise, I stepped in and took over his drug business.
Right. And at the time of you taking over the business, Ms. Wright. Did you know the seriousness of the business when you was taking it over, or you were just looking at it, I got to continue this money flow to take care of me and my kids?
No, by the time that my husband was murdered, I was fully aware of the dangers that were involved. But, you know, we always think that we're going to do things differently. My husband was murdered in the city of Philadelphia. At that time, I was living in Los Angeles. He had sent myself and my son away for our safety earlier that year. And so I was well aware of what could happen, but I figured living in Los Angeles and doing most of my business in Philadelphia, you know, would actually allow me a little more safety net, you know, where I could travel, handle my business in Los Angeles. At the time, I had developed a sportswear business with a partner in Los Angeles, so I felt as though I could maneuver a little better living in Los Angeles and doing business on the East Coast.
And when you really found out that you could maneuver on that East Coast and West Coast, because, you know, like we all know in the game, things get bad when they think the main player is away, you know? So when did you start seeing that this game is starting to get real tricky?
Well, the way I did my business was completely different than the way my husband did. I dealt all weight. So my business was pretty much cash and carry, you know. I did business only with people that I knew. You know, if you were brought in, you had to be brought in by someone that I fully trusted. It was more like a family business, you know. I kept things close with people that I knew, people who had established, you know, themselves with my husband. So things went really well almost 5 years. I had a good almost five-year run before things began to crumble. And then when they crumbled all together. You know, within 60 days, everything happened. I had someone that was very dear to me get killed. He had nothing to do with my business, but he was involved in the game himself, and we were at the wrong place at the wrong time, and a shootout happened, and he was hit. He was killed in July of 1991. Within 2 weeks' time, someone that I was doing business with was busted. And within 3 weeks of that time, the late August of 1991, my connect was killed as well. She was in the wrong place at the wrong time. So I felt as though all the writing was on the wall. You know, if I did not take heed to these messages that were coming my way that were very close, I knew that I could be killed or go to jail. And what would happen to my child? You know, I realized I had no business in that game. You know, it really was, I felt as though, a man's game, but I did what I needed to do, you know, to keep my head above water, to try to maintain things as best as I could for me and my son and try to prepare for our future. But, you know, it always turns out the same way. You're either going to jail or you're going to get killed, and I came very close to both.
Right. And with that being said, Ms. Wright, can you give the viewers, you know, especially the ones, the youngsters out here that's thinking that lifestyle is so cool and so glamorous, can you give them a big view of that picture of what you're going to be expecting when you step up in that thing that they call the game?
Well, you know, back in that time, things were a lot different. I mean, you know, people did not, it was more so, it wasn't the first one to the gate so much back in that time. You know what I mean? People were really about trying to handle their business and make money, you know, to be successful, to prepare for their futures, to take care of their families. That's why a lot of people got involved in the drug game. It was so much money to be made at that time. You know, the temptations were there just as they are now, but there was so much more money to be made. But there's always someone, you know, lurking in the background that feels that they can handle that thing better than you. They feel as though, you know, they should be in the position that you're in, you know, and you're always going to run into that. That never changes But nowadays, there is no money to be made. You cannot beat the system. The time that you're facing when you get involved in the drug game is astronomical. You know what I mean? The mandatory minimums that they're trying to cut back now. You know, all of my friends either got 20, 30 years or life sentences or even death row. You know, it just, it's a no-win situation. So to get involved in that game, you're going to lose. You cannot beat that game. You cannot beat the system. You know, you may get a, you know, a year run here and there, but, you know, with more money comes more problems.
Right, right. And that's just the same thing I tell these youngsters too, Ms. Wright, when I speak to them. You know, it's like back in the 80s when everybody was getting money. You know, you could drop 10 birds at your homeboy and say, get at me in a week or two. You know what I mean? All the money going to be there. You know what I'm saying? Nowadays, there's no money to be made, like you said. It's nothing but a headache and your own people to cross you out for a few thousand dollars that can't even get them to China and back, you know? So it's just a deadly thing out here. And it's about, like I tell them, it's about this global hustle now. If you're going to hustle, global hustle. You know, you can get your PayPal account on the Internet. You can sell socks, shoes, drawers, hats, you know what I mean, around the globe. Now, that's the real hustle. What you think, Ms. Wright?
I agree 100%. It's just not worth it. I mean, people are not making enough money now to pay attorneys, you know, to make bails. The system has, you know, developed a process of what you have to go through just to pay a bail or just to make someone's bail is unbelievable. You have to have a paper trail of where your money comes from. Everything now is accountability. It used to be, you know, back in those times when people were arrested and you went to pay a bail, you just paid a bail. There was no questions asked, you know. If a bail was $50,000, you paid 10% of that bail and you went on, you know what I mean? And you kept it moving. But nowadays you can't do that, from my understanding. You know, if you're working and you go to pay someone's bail, you have to produce your pay stubs. If you're putting up your house, there's a whole, you know, list of things that you have to go through to do that. You know, I watch these young kids nowadays. They're hustling for nothing. They're not making any money. They're still living at Big Mama's house. They don't have a car. You know what I mean? They can't make bails. They can't pay lawyers. They're working with public defenders. Your chances of going to jail with a public defender is almost 90% that you're not going to beat that case. You're going to take a plea deal. They're not giving out deals. There is no more first to the gate because everybody's running to the gate. All the institutions are filled with people, you know, trying to trade places and trying to make deals. They're not doing that anymore.
No, they just sending you straight on away from them.
Exactly. So what is it all about? What are you getting from this?
Right. You know, what you're getting is a headache in a penitentiary case. You know what I mean? And like you said, Ms. Wright, back in our days, I'm 50, and I know you're around that age too. When we was in the game coming up back in the day, you always was prepared because you had your bondsman, you had your lawyer, you had your man that held the money. If you get caught up, your man knew to take that over there to the bondsman. Your lawyer knew what time it was. Nobody has that nowadays because they ain't even making that kind of money to even have that, like you said. They still at mama's house and just getting high all day and chilling, you know what I mean? And there's
exactly.
No money to be made on the block.
No. You know, I'm a little older than you, but, you know, back in those times, people were hustling for a reason. They were trying to get someplace. They were trying to do something.
Yes.
They had enough room to make a lot of money, to start a business, to take that money and build for your future. Can't do that now. So my question to them is always, what is it for? What is it all about? What is it that you're trying to do? And then when the gunplay jumps off, you know, I talk about this in my documentary, you know, If you're in the game and there's no bodies coming up, there's no harm done to anyone, you might skate for a while. But how long is that going to last? Because there's always someone who wants to take your place. There's always someone who's going to challenge you. So you're dealing with the authorities. You're dealing with the people in the street. You're dealing with the people that's crossing you because they're not going to pay you. You know what I mean? They want to come at you crazy. You know, they want to take what you have. There's too many elements against you in these streets. So what is it all about? Get your education. You know, I always taught my son, get as much education as you can, because they can take the material things from you, but they can never take your education from you.
Amen, Ms. Wright. And just by you touching up on that, Ms. Wright, when your son found out what really was going down, how did that make him feel when you had to do that one-on-one with him?
Well, you know, it was really amazing, because by the time I had decided to sit my son down and talk to him about what I had done, I had talked to him through his years, especially in his years of college, about his father, because my mother had always instructed me never to tell him things unless he asked. Once he asked those questions, you would know that he was ready for the answers. So mm-hmm. It was in 2008 that I was approached by someone from Los Angeles who was interested in possibly getting the options to do my story. And there was no way that I would tell my story without first telling my son about his mother. And so by the time we had that discussion, he was already out of college. He had been out of college about 3 years. So, you know, it was very difficult for me. I think the most difficult of the whole entire story was the fact that I had been shot, you know, because I had never, you know, his father was never here to talk about what he had done. And when his father died, he was only 3 years old. So I never wanted to taint, you know, whatever ideas and thoughts that he had about his dad. You know, I know he held those sacred to his heart, so I never wanted to do anything to diminish that, you know what I mean? So that was the most difficult thing for me, to tell him, you know, things that his father and I had gone to way before, you know, he was born way before he was, these things happened before he was born, but I wanted him to know how much his father loved him and that everything we did was for his future, because Jackie and I always talked about and always planned that my son would have a better life than we did. We wanted to keep him out of the streets. We wanted to educate him as much as possible, give him the best education that money could buy. So that's what it was all about. And when my son said to me, you know, what he said to me was really amazing, because he said to me, "Mom, I'm a grown man. Whatever you did, I know you did for us." He said, "I'm good. I'm all right. So if you're going to tell it, you got to tell it all." So once he gave me that green light, I was good, because that was what it was all about, you know. I had no idea what the feedback was going to be like about my story, and, you know, I didn't have any idea that I would touch people the way I've been able to do, you know. It was more so something that I felt I needed to do for me and my son, to set the record straight about what really happened to his father. You know what I mean? To set the record straight about what went on in my life. It was actually a cleansing process for me. And it just took off. You know, people have really been amazed and touched by my story. So, you know, that's been a gift, you know, for me. The feedback that I've been getting has allowed me to be able to give back to people. So that's what it's all about now.
Right. And you know, when I've seen your story, Ms. Wright, I told my wife, I say, "Well, I'm going to have to try to get in touch with Ms. Wright people some kind of way, because her story definitely needs to keep floating on radio, TV, and everywhere, because your story is a real story, and it's a story of education, and it's a story of this is what you don't want to go through in life." You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
At the end of the day.
Exactly.
This is what your story is, and it had meant a lot to me. So I'm going to pass the mic over to my missus. And once again, we just want to thank you again, Ms. Wright, for giving us this time.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I wanted to have you go back a little bit and talk about how you met Jackie and what, you know, as a young teenage girl, you know, you said you had so much going for you. What drew you to him?
Well, excuse me, I had heard of Jackie prior to meeting him. During the late 70s, Philly was really jumping here. You know, there was the Sound of Philadelphia that was really kicking off. There was a lot of money being made in the city. And I had heard about him And one day walking home from work on South Broad Street, we made eye contact with each other. And I said to myself, that must be that guy, because I saw him driving that pretty red convertible Eldorado that I had heard about. And I said, oh, that must be that guy, you know, but I kept walking and he kept driving. And then later that summer, we were introduced by an associate of his. And he had a charisma and a charm. He was a charmer, and he was very handsome. And he was always really, really sharp. You know, back in those times, you know, guys were putting clothes on. They were dressing, you know what I mean, like Detroit and Chicago, New York. Philly right. Brothers were putting clothes on, you know what I'm saying? So he was that guy back then, very handsome guy, you know. And he was very personable and very polite and very caring, you know. But just as he had all those, you know, great qualities, he was very dangerous, you know. But I always felt very comfortable with him. I always felt very safe with him. You know, he always protected me. And he always made me feel very secure. And so, you know, it was very easy to fall in love with him.
Yes, you there, Miss Wright?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, she's right there.
Okay.
So, can you hear me?
I can hear you now. It went out for just a second.
Okay.
So, what was the first time that you guys actually went out and you knew that was going to be your man?
Well, when we met, we would run into – he was in another relationship and I was in another relationship when we first met. So when we would run into each other from time to time, we would just talk and have friendly conversation. He was very easy to talk to. And then a few months later, it was in November of 77 – he asked me to go out with him, and I was apprehensive because, you know, he was that guy. So, and as I said, he was 10 years older than me, so I couldn't imagine, you know, why he would want to take me out, you know. And so I was apprehensive about it, and he said, well, you know, we could take a ride, we could go to movies, whatever. And I said, okay, and I felt like I knew him, you know, because like I said, we would run into each other on the streets from time to time and talk. And we went out that night, and we rode half the night just talking. You know, we stopped, and we ate, and we laughed, and we talked, and I felt very comfortable with him. And that was it. I mean, from the first night we went out, that was it. It was just a chemistry that was there between us, you know, and it just lasted until his death.
Now, you mentioned that you got shot. What happened in that situation?
Well, we had been together, I'd say, almost 2 years by this time. And one of his associates had died suddenly of a heart attack. And they wasn't sure if, you know, what had happened. They wasn't sure if someone poisoned him or what had happened. And the city went into complete panic. And prior to that, Jackie had been shot himself, and he started taking pills and getting high, you know, periodically. And when his friend, when Large died, I believe they went into a panic. Well, I was working at the time, and he would either send someone to pick me up or he would pick me up himself. And this particular day was my birthday. And he sent his friend to pick me up from work, and I didn't understand why I hadn't talked to him all that day. So when I got off of work, you know, I asked his friend, where was he? You know, why hadn't I seen him? And he said, well, you know, they were taking care of some business. I asked him where he was. He told me where he was. I said, okay, I'm going to drive over there. He said, well, I'm going to go with you. And when I met up with Jackie, he was high, and he was a little upset, you know. They had been out all day, I guess, trying to collect money that was out in the streets, because back in that time, and I guess even in this time, I would assume, you know, when someone dies and you're in the game, they think, well, the debt's been paid, I don't have to pay the debt. But that wasn't the case. So we had a few words, you know. I asked him, you know, why hadn't I talked to him that day, and he kind of flagged me off, you know, look, I'm busy. I got some things I got to do. I got to collect this money, go home. I'll see you when I get home. And I was upset with him. And but I listened and I said, okay, you know, and I went to walk away. And when I walked away, I turned around and I looked back at him, you know, in a very upset look on my face with my head kind of tilted. And I guess he didn't like that. And as I went to walk away and I turned back and looked back, I could see the gun. But I still, I didn't have a fear. You know, I saw the gun. I'd seen him with guns before. And as I took the next step, I collapsed. And he had shot me in the leg. And everybody went into complete panic. You know, and I write about that in my book with Ash on Both Sides. I talk about that whole scene and, you know, how that happened and, you know, me just not understanding, you know, why he would pull a weapon out on me. I was not a threat to him. I would never have done anything to hurt him. He knew that. But I guess it was being in his right mind, you know, and that's what happened with the shooting.
Wow. And how did he feel about that afterwards?
Well, he called my mom, you know, from my understanding, from what he said and what my mother said, he called her immediately after they told him to leave, his friends told him to leave, that I would be okay, they would take care of me. And he immediately went and he called my mother and he told her what he had done. And he said that he didn't mean to do it. He said it was an accident, he didn't mean to do it, but he just shot too straight. And then after I was released from the hospital, we talked. And he kept trying to convince me, you know, that he didn't mean to do it, that he was sorry, it was an accident. And I said, but why? My whole question was, why would you pull a gun out on me? I was not a threat to you. I never tried to hurt you in any way. I never could understand why he did that. But eventually I just accepted it. You know, we did break up for a period of time. It wasn't a long period of time. And I refer to that in my book as crazy love because that's what it was. You know, anytime you're in a relationship with someone and they hurt you in any way, it's a relationship that you don't need to be in, especially when it's physical abuse, even if it's mental abuse. You know, when someone loves you, they shouldn't hurt you.
Right. And even if he was pulling the gun out to maybe just scare you or, you know, that's still, you know, that's a form of domestic violence. It's a threat.
That's exactly what it is. And, you know, I think that we women need to understand and accept things for what they are and not rewrite the handwriting. You know, it is what it is. But at that time, I rewrote it, you know. I never wanted to accept that it was what it was. And I never, you know, I never felt as though at that time that I could live without him. I just loved him so, you know. And we have to learn to love from afar, you know. If that love is going to hurt you, if that love is bringing you harm, then you have to learn to love from afar.
That's right. So what advice would you give out there to young girls, good girls that like the bad boys?
Well, I understand perfectly well, you know, how women are attracted to bad boys because we women, we want to feel as though that, you know, the man that we're with, that he loves us, that he's going to provide for us, that he's going to protect us, that he's going to profess his love. And bad boys will do that. They will stand up for you. You know, they will kill the world for you. But we also need to understand that we women need to get as much education as we can to be able to provide for ourselves, to have bigger and better options for ourselves. You know, and I think that if we do that, we're less apt to go in that direction. You know, our options become greater. You know what I'm saying? So my key and what I'm stressing to women, you know, when I'm speaking and, you know, and promoting my book and telling my story, I'm pleading with women to get their education, to educate yourself as much as you can to be able to provide for yourself. those are the things that I'm pushing for our women.
Exactly. I think, you know, that whole era back, you know, with the gangster era, I think it maybe it's starting to fade away a little bit, but it was so big that people thought, you know, like you said, a lot of people did it for necessity in the beginning. You know, if I can do this, I can, you know, get out of the ghetto, or I can get out of the hood, or, you know, I can have that nice house on top of the hill. But then they get greedy, and that's when, you know, things start turning bad. But, you know, nowadays, like you said, it doesn't, it's not like it was back in that era, and it never will be again. But if we can just educate the youth, men and women, boys and girls, to get their education, to be able to, you know, wait and don't have your kids, don't get pregnant, you know, get your education first, go to school, and you still can have that nice car and that house on the hill. You don't have to use drug money to get it. You can have an education. You can start your own business. You can, I mean, there's so many things in this world that you can do and achieve and accomplish without doing the wrong things. So we just need to, you know, it's not wrong to have all those nice things. It's just there's a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it.
Exactly. And they need to understand that, because once you have your education, as I said before, they can't take that from you. You know, education,
exactly.
Degrees, things like that, they cannot take. But those material things, especially when you acquire them the wrong way, you know, illegally through drug money, various things like that, you can lose all of those things. They can take those things from you.
Exactly.
Amen, right there, you know. And Ms. Wright, I wanted to just ask you also, what are you doing now? You know, I know you always have gave back to the community, even when you was doing your wrongdoings. But update the people, what are you doing now in your community of Philly with the women and men?
Currently, I am working for a nonprofit organization. I deal with women who have transitioned from drug, alcohol treatment, and mental health. And I work as a property manager right now, but I'm also interacting with women who are single heads of household and their children. So, you know, I do speaking engagements. I will travel and do speaking engagements. I do book signings, appearances, you know, wherever I speak at schools. I've spoken recently at Penn State in the criminal justice classes at the Abington campus as well as the Brandywine campus. I speak in the alternative schools for our youth. Last year I was a keynote speaker at the Women's Correctional Facility, Riverside Correctional Facility in Philadelphia. So I'm trying to get in where I can fit in, wherever I can go to get the word out, you know, about my story. And I'm saying, listen, this is what went on with me. You know, just because I was able to escape with no drug time, you know, God blessed me for a reason to be able to come back and say, hey, you don't want to do this. You do not want to get involved in this game. This is a no-win. There's only two options. That is death and jail, nothing else.
Yeah, and that's for real. So I'm going to pass the mic over to the missus, and you're doing a great, great thing, Ms. Wright, and I just want you to keep up doing the work that God got you doing out here to help save lives, you know. Just keep pushing like you're doing, you know what I mean, because it's all on the right point.
Thank you so much. And once again, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome. I wanted to ask you and have you talk a little bit about what made you decide that it was time to get out of the game.
Well, as I said earlier, once those three things happened to me, and they happened very quickly, in July of 1991, my friend was murdered, July 11th to be exact. 2 weeks later, one of my associates was busted. 3 weeks' time, my connect in Los Angeles was murdered. So that was it. That was a wrap for me. That was three things, you know. And I realized they were all very close. One thing had something to do with me. The other two were situations where they happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time. But these were people that I loved dearly. These were people that were very close to me. And these were people that was all involved in the drug game. So I knew that was it. Because if I did not pay attention to the signs that were given to me, that I was going to either go to jail or I was going to get killed. And I did not want that to happen. You know, my whole thing was, what's going to happen to my son if something happens to me? So, you know,
how was the decision
that I made. Pardon me?
How old was your son when you decided to get out of it?
My son was, you see, 1991, he was 8. He was 8 years
okay.
old.
So you just walked away from it completely?
I just completely walked away. That's right, completely walked away. No jail time, no drug usage. You know, and I went to work. I started out with a job making something like $19,000 a year. I probably had made $19,000 in a couple of seconds. So, you know, but it was all about my safety. It was all about the safety of my son. It was all about my freedom, you know, and it was all about living my life and being alive to be here to raise my son. That was my priority. It was not about the money. It was not about the material things because I had all of that. And, you know, just to be able to walk away and not look back was a wonderful thing. You know, it was difficult at first, you know, because now you're adjusting from one particular lifestyle to another lifestyle. But I was very happy. You know, I was very happy and I felt very comfortable and I felt at peace.
Did you ever feel after that anybody from the past would maybe come and try to do something?
No, I never. The only thing I was concerned about the possibility of getting a conspiracy charge for the case that my associate, you know, did get. I was worried about that because if he would have connected me to that case, there was a possibility that I could have gotten a conspiracy charge, but I did not have a record. So it was, you know, at that time and during that time, I may have just walked away with that. You know, I would have had to fight it. It would have been an uncomfortable situation to be in, but there was a strong possibility I could have beat it. But I didn't even want to go through that, you know. But that was the closest that I ever came to anything like that, and that was very scary for me, you know. It had
right.
only been 5 years since my husband's death, so I still wasn't over that. I never really mourned that situation until some years later, you know.
Right.
So it was very scary, you know what I mean? And I realized that was a business that I really never should have gotten involved in. But I just felt very grateful, you know, even to this day. I thank God every day that I was able to walk away like that. Who can do that? You know, how many people can say, you know, I just walked away? And people ask me, well, how are you able to do that? I was able to do that because I was the connect. I didn't owe anyone any money. Now, had I had a tab someplace, I probably could not have walked away like that without paying that tab. And I don't advise
right.
anyone to try to do that, you know, without
right.
paying your
exactly.
tab because you're going to have a problem. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
But by me being the connect, by me being the person that people were getting the drugs from, I was able to say, "Ooh, I'm done. That's it. I'm done with that. I don't never want to do that yep. again, ever."
Now, you mentioned your brothers and your family. Did any of your brothers get involved in the life, or did they ever try to keep you away from it?
Oh, no. No, no. They would never. None of my siblings were ever involved in the game. I'm quite sure they may have socially, you know, like a lot of people did, they probably socially got high or something, never around me,
mm-hmm.
never with me because I never got high. But they were in corporate America. My brother worked for the post office until he retired. I have another brother who's in corporate America to this day. He's actually getting ready to retire. My sisters are younger than I am, and they just had very good jobs, you know. I was the only one who got involved in that game, you know, to that capacity like that.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, we know that, you know, it's a lot of people say, you know, I can't get out of it. I can't turn my back. And you hear kids say this, you know, I can't get out of the gang. You know, I'll get, you know, killed or something. But people, you can. You can walk, turn around and walk right away. You don't have to let people control you and use you and abuse you. You know, you have the right to make your decisions and you have the right, you know, to walk away from the gangs or the drugs or the game, you know. What's your advice on that?
You know, I'm a firm believer that we people can do whatever you want to do. You just have to put your mind to and you have to make a decision that this is what I'm going to do and this is what I want to do. It may not be as easy for some as it is for others. You know, but you can't do it. You can seek the resources to do it. You can seek the help to do it if that's what you really want to do. But what I have learned about life, period, is that reach out. You know, you sometimes things are bigger than you, and sometimes you do need help. Don't be afraid to ask for help if that's what you need. Do what you need to do to better yourself. Do what you need to do to help yourself. But I do believe that people can walk away if that's what they really want to do. But you have to want it. It's not something I can tell you to do. It has to be something that you want to do. And I wanted to do that. It wasn't nobody needed to tell me anything. I knew when those three things happened just like that, boom, 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 that was it. I'm done. I didn't need to consult
right.
with anybody. I didn't need to ask anybody. I just went underground, and it was something that I knew I wanted to do for me and for my child.
Right. Well, you know you made the right decision because you could have waited another week or two, and you could have, I mean, you could be doing life in prison or something, and then your son wouldn't have had a mom or a dad, you know.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
Definitely, you definitely did the right thing, and we commend you on that. And we just want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story with the world. You know, it's we just have to get these messages out there that you can change your life, and you don't have to live that way just because you were put in that situation, you know, and like you said, you can do anything you want to do in this world if you just put your mind to it.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I would like to give my website out once again. I'm so sorry for my voice tonight, but these allergies and a cold has really been working me. But my website is www.selmabewright.com. And the title of the book is With Eyes from Both Sides, Living My Life in and Out of the Game. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate you, you know, reaching out and taking the time to bring me on to your show.
Well, you're welcome. And we wish you all the best. And we hope that you get over your little cold. And I'm going to turn the mic over to Rob here just before we end the show. Thank you once again for coming on the show.
You're welcome.
Yes, ma'am, Ms. Wright. Yeah, once again, we want to say we appreciate you coming on here, sharing your message, and tell Ms. Smith, you know what I mean, I kept my word. I wasn't going to hold you past 12:30, and we're gonna keep it moving, you know. So any last great words you would like to give to our viewers and our youth out here before we close out, Ms. Wright?
Yes, I would like to say for anyone that's still involved in that game, please think about the consequences that you're facing. You know, your run will not be long. you know, as I said, they cannot win this drug game, but they are containing it. So it is something that you need to seriously think about, and you need to walk away as well. God bless to everyone, and thank you once again for having me.